This is Here's How, Ireland's political, social and current affairs podcast, presented by William Campbell.
Thank you for downloading episode 3 of Here's How. In this episode, we talk about the marriage referendum, again, air code, the new postcode system, again, the rights of smokers, the rights of non-smokers, and the rights of tobacco companies.
Here's How is Ireland's political, social and current affairs podcast. Make your view heard. Just dial 076 603 5060 and tell the world what you're thinking. Your voicemail may be included in the next podcast. You can find tips on recording your contribution and other ways to contact the show at hereshow.ie/call.
And we begin this episode with a reading from the Holy Bible. Please turn to the book of Deuteronomy, chapter 22, verses 28 to 29. If a man find a damsel that is a virgin which is not betrothed, and lay hold on her, and he lie with her, and they be found, then the man that lay with her shall give unto the damsel's father 50 shekels of silver, and she shall be his wife, because he hath humbled her, and he may not put her away all his days. That's the King James translation, usually used by English-speaking Protestants. The translation of the same passage, typically used by Catholics, is, if a man comes upon a young woman, a virgin, who is not betrothed, and seizes her, and lies with her, and they are discovered, the man who lay with her shall give the young woman's father 50 shekels of silver, and she will be his wife, because he has violated her. He may not divorce her as long as he lives. Now, whether your translation is rough or smooth, or Catholic or Protestant, the meaning of that is pretty clear. The punishment set out in the Bible for raping a virgin, an unmarried woman, those two things were considered to be equal, the punishment was a payment to the woman's father, not to her, to her father, of 50 shekels of silver, and he would be required to marry the woman and never divorce her. That is simply an incomprehensible way of dealing with rape to us. We simply can't understand it. I've looked for some online defences from Christian fundamentalists of that particular Bible passage, and the only thing that I could come up with was a theory that this rule would never have applied because the situation would never have arisen. I don't think that's very plausible. But it's impossible to understand that Bible passage unless you understand the context in which it was written. At that time, marriage was, and was only, a contract between two men where one man would sell his daughter to become the wife of the other in return for money, a dowry, or some other consideration. Girls, and it was girls, not women, girls had no say over whether, to who, or when they would get married. The idea of a man asking a woman to marry him would have been as ridiculous to the early Iron Age people who wrote this chapter of the Bible as us asking a cow whether it would agree to become our dinner. The past is truly a different country. Last week, the Irish Catholic bishops issued a statement which said, "We cannot support an amendment to the Constitution which redefines marriage and effectively places the union of two men or two women on a par with the marriage relationship between a husband and wife." This phrase is thrown around a lot, accusing the yes side in the referendum of redefining marriage. Maybe it's correct, maybe not. I'd suppose you could argue that the referendum is extending the definition of marriage rather than changing it. It's not like the definition of marriage that we have now is going to be prohibited, not in any case if we get the Irish language translation correct. But let's say that they're right, that this amounts to redefining marriage. So what? All through the Middle Ages and into modernity, marriage changed. The concept of romantic love was invented, and up until recently, it would have been normal to ask the bride's father for his permission to marry his daughter. Now, marriage is an entirely voluntary institution for both parties. No relatives have any say in the matter at all, and that change was done by Christians. Canon law in the Catholic Church demands that marriage be voluntary for both parties, and it's invalid if it's not. Not only have we redefined marriage before to make it fully voluntary, we now totally reject the old definition of marriage Anyone trying to conduct a marriage, as it is defined in the Bible, would be breaking the criminal law and would most likely end up in jail.
Do you agree? Do you disagree? If you want your point of view heard, dial 076 603 5060 and leave a contribution for the show. The lines are open 24/7 and you can find tips on how to record a good contribution and other ways to contact the podcast at hereshow.ie/call.
And we're joined now by John Mallon of Forest Éireann. John, can you tell me who are you and what is Forest Éireann?
That's right. Forest Éireann is the freedom organisation for the right to enjoy smoking tobacco. The operative word there is freedom.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just an ordinary Joel Soap, semi-retired, doing a bit of writing. And I was amazed and confused and then annoyed when I did the research when the smoking ban was brought in here. In fact, even before the smoking ban was brought in, I was furiously writing to the newspaper saying it didn't make sense. And since then, of course, several times a year we've had attacks on smokers, right all the way up to a campaign to denormalise us.
Okay, I want to just tackle that, because yesterday I contacted JTI, which is Japan Tobacco International, and Philip Morris, and both of their PR offices, their press offices, are in Switzerland. I emailed them, and I actually got them on the phone. Both of them just gave me very polite but very firm answers. They don't do interviews. And I was also doing some research, particularly about Philip Morris and their internal documents, which are available on the internet. The Forest in the UK was established by the tobacco companies. That's correct, isn't it?
No. Forest in the UK was actually established by an old gentleman who flew fighters during the Second World War.
And the funding for that?
The funding then, initially, the funding was from various sources, if you like, at the beginning.
How much of the funding didn't come from tobacco companies?
I don't know at the start. I had nothing to do with Forest.
Well, let me give you just a little bit of the information that I've received. One of the tobacco company internal documents observed that it wasn't in their interest to present opposition to clean air legislation as coming from smoking companies. They wanted to present it as coming from smokers. And that was the genesis of a strategy to set up in each of the democratic countries. They had a different strategy in dictatorships, but in democratic countries, to set up a front organization that was to appear as representing smokers. So just very, to let you answer the question, do you represent tobacco companies or do you represent smokers?
Good Lord, no. I certainly don't represent tobacco companies, and I would have grave differences with them on certain matters. Initially, what happened when I started with this, I was once or twice.
No, but just to answer the one question: Do you say you represent smokers?
Yeah, I represent smokers.
And how many smokers would be members or paid up members of Forest Éireann?
Well, you see, we're not a paid up member organisation. We rely on the vocal support and the encouragement that I get on both mobile phones and through email. I get a lot of encouragement to continue, and thank you for representing us and so on. And I get a lot of suggestions for things I should be saying as well.
And where does the funding come from?
Ordinary smokers. But it is the, really, the smoker himself has had no voice, or herself, simply because we're talked over. There seems to be a shouting match from one side, shouting at the tobacco companies, and the million plus of us in this country are just completely ignored. But everything that's done affects us. Price increases, bans, you can't smoke here, you can't smoke there.
Okay, but John, just to deal with the one point, where does your funding come from?
Yeah, okay, the funding as such comes from three of the four tobacco companies to the UK.
Uh-huh.
And what it does, in the beginning, and that's what I set out to try to explain, I was asked several times, I was contacted and asked if I would travel to a studio in Dublin, for example. I couldn't afford to do that. So when Forest contacted me, they said, well, look, if you do need to travel or expenses of any kind, we'll cover them.
And what's the annual budget on that?
Yeah.
What sort of annual budget would you have on that?
I've no idea what the annual budget is. I do know that I've contacted them several times saying, look, can we do an MRBI poll, for example?
Uh-huh.
to be told that apparently it was £5,000 per question.
Okay. Well, let's leave that aside. I think we're fairly clear just on your own relationship with the man.
The important thing is, mm-hmm. Facing me or condemning me all the time would be the likes of the Irish Cancer Society in Dublin, mm-hmm. whose annual turnover runs to many millions. The Irish Heart Foundation, again, huge budgets. And state money as well, driving these.
Absolutely. And you're certainly correct that there's an awful lot of funding in the anti-smoking lobby coming from, as you say, cancer research people and from Department of Health and so forth.
Exactly.
Somebody who is countering that would say that tobacco companies make a huge amount of profit from selling cigarettes. They're highly motivated to do what it takes to keep selling cigarettes and to sell as many cigarettes as possible. They wouldn't be funding you if they thought that that didn't work, would they?
Well, no. If you think about it, it's like an owner's club, if you like, an Alfa Romeo owner's club. The company will at times help them out financially if they want a new headquarters. And now we don't have a headquarters as such, but it would be in their interest to have the voice of the ordinary smoker heard. Now, if it wasn't in their interest when that voice was saying that people should try e-cigarettes, which I was saying for quite some time and still do, because they don't sell them.
Mm-hmm. But e-cigarettes do help to keep smoking normalised, which does help them.
No, e-cigarettes don't keep smoking normalised. When e-cigarettes is vaping. It's an entirely different.
I know what it is.
Yeah. Different industry.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, let's move on because I know that you're interested in the plain packaging law, which is on its way through the Oireachtas at the moment. Tell me your view on that.
Well, I think the plain packaging law. Maybe I need to go back. I thought initially when the smoking ban came in that this was about health. It was purely to do with health. Mm-hmm. And I read up all the condemnation of cigarettes, and it was about cigarette smoke. The smoke from cigarettes is a danger. A cigarette lying on the table on its own, unlit, presented no danger to anybody. It was a plant wrapped in paper, and paper was from a plant as well. It was all natural. When you lit it, though, the smoke from it was where the danger came.
Yeah.
Which is my argument, of course, for vaping, because there's no tobacco and no smoke, right? It's an illusion. But the more and more it went on, for example, the constant increase in pricing. I remember way back when it started saying, look, if the price goes up too much, you'll create a criminal problem with counterfeit and the illicit trade. And sure enough, the IRA in this country got onto it straight away. It was a huge profit earner.
There's a huge amount of tobacco smuggling in Ireland.
Huge amount of it.
Yeah, where do the cigarettes come from?
Well, at the moment, it looks like they're making them themselves. They're importing the tobacco.
Hang on a second here. Because I have done research on this, yes. And BAT, British American Tobacco in particular, have acknowledged in court documents that they supply smugglers in order to evade smoking regulations.
Well, no, I haven't read that, and I would condemn.
Well, I'll put links for that on the page for this show, and I have some other data as well. But let's just focus specifically on plain packaging because that's what's in the news at the moment.
Okay.
What if anything is the problem with that?
Well, from my perspective, it's just another go at smokers. You know, it's like we causes of death in this country are many and varied. We have nearly 30,000 deaths a year in Ireland. We're told 5,000 of them. Are as a direct result of smoking.
Mm-hmm.
What are the other 25,000 as a direct result of? It's constantly picking on the smoker.
Can you make that link? How is plain packaging picking on a smoker?
Well, hang on, William. You're not giving me a chance here to develop.
Go ahead.
The thought for you, right? I thought that this was about health in the beginning. I quickly saw through it. It has nothing to do with health. This is politics and ideology. This is people who have a personal preference for not smoking, which is fine, but they then want everybody else not to smoke because they don't like it. And they have a massive lobby in Dublin. They talk about the tobacco lobby. I don't see the tobacco companies lobbying at all, but I see all the charities, the so-called registered charities in this country, lobbying like crazy. And every time they want something, they get it. The politicians do as they're told. The plain packaging is another go at smokers, this awful, disgraceful denormalisation of ordinary, decent people. And it's another hit against us. We're going to make the boxes your stuff comes in disgusting.
Mm-hmm. Can I put to you the counter argument? The overwhelming majority of smokers begin smoking before they're aged 18 and before people are allowed to make decisions, for example, voting. Most smokers have made a decision to, if you want to call it a decision, they have started smoking and become addicted before they're aged 18. If it is the case that tobacco companies don't want to sell tobacco to children, this seems to me a very good way to put children off starting smoking. I think the tobacco companies perhaps are opposing that because they know that people who don't start smoking by the time they're 18 never start.
Quite possibly. But, William, the reality is, in the 1960s in Ireland, about 70% of the population smoked.
Mm-hmm.
Today we're told it's about 20%.
Yeah, so there's been a fairly, with increasing smoking regulation, there's been a fairly clear decline in smoking.
No. If you want the facts, what actually happened was they introduced the ban in 2004.
Yeah.
And in 2005, the Office of Tobacco Control reported that the smoking rates were now 23.5% in Ireland.
Mm-hmm.
That was in 2005, after the ban came in.
Yeah.
Okay. Then progressively, 2007, we were told it was 27%. Then we were told in 2011 it was 29%. And in 2000...
Without overwhelming people with figures, can you give me just your interpretation of the trend?
No, but you're interrupting me again.
Yeah, no, but people won't necessarily be able to visualise the figures. If you can tell me when it went up and down without going too deeply into the figures.
Okay, from the time they started tinkering with it, it was falling of natural causes all the way up to the ban. And when they started highlighting it, the number of smoking rose drastically. Eurostat reported the Irish smoking rates at 31%.
Mm-hmm.
That's what actually happened.
And would you not accept that has something to do with the amount of money in the economy as well? When people are richer, they can afford more cigarettes.
Of course not.
but smoking did go up in the boom and went down in the crash.
Well, went down in the crash. You know, a packet of cigarettes now in the shop is €10. Down the road from the shop, a fella selling from the boot of his car will give them to you for €3.50.
Yeah.
You know, what would you buy?
Well, I think that it's fairly clearly demonstrated that pricing does have a connection with smoking levels. But just to focus on the plain packaging, aside from whether you think it's right or wrong, do you think it'll work?
No, of course it won't work. I don't see how...
Why not?
It'll work for the counterfeiters. Because currently in Ireland, by law, when you go to a shop to buy your brand, right?
Mm-hmm.
This is branding, not marketing. There's a confusion here. The box is branding. It's one company saying this is our brand as opposed to another company's brand. They compete with each other for the market. Right?
But also they want to make their product as attractive as possible.
Well... I don't see how a cigarette box is attractive. I mean, the groceries come home here every week, and there's all sorts of colourful labelling in them and all that sort of stuff, the various foods. It doesn't make them more attractive or less attractive to me. I know what I like to eat, and I know what I like to smoke. It's similar, if you like, to the beer man. When you go to the pub, you know what your brand is, Heineken or whatever, right? And you ask for it by name.
But at some point you made a decision to start getting that brand, and that's very much influenced by the branding.
No, at one point, I'm sure, I don't know, I've changed brands several times. But what I'm saying is, your original question, you asked this question...
Yeah, will it work?
...not work. Well, currently, the gruesome images, such as they are from medical textbooks, are on the packs. The packs are hidden behind the door. You have to ask for them by name. You'll still have to do that, and the box you get will just be the same as every other one, but it'll have the name of your brand on it.
So just you're saying kind of your intuition is that it won't work?
Well, I couldn't see how it would.
Let me just quote from The Guardian from a couple of days ago. In Australia, in the 2 years following the introduction of plain packaging, cigarette consumption has gone down by 13%.
Well, you see, it's very confusing coming out of Australia. The Retailers Association are reporting on the sales of cigarettes, and various charities are doing these short research projects, asking people about smoking less.
Well, just to give the information that I have, this is from the just so that we know we're both talking about the same thing. The Australian Health Ministry says the total tobacco consumption has fallen 12.8% since the introduction of plain packaging in Australia.
Right, and the border police and excise people in Australia who are actually policing a continental border say that the incidence of smuggling has gone crazy.
Mm-hmm.
So people are sourcing there. And the Health Ministry issuing figures on the sales of tobacco is ridiculous. That's nonsense. The people who sell tobacco will tell you how much, whether it's gone up or down.
Mm-hmm.
And I've spoken to the retailers in Ireland, and they say that their figures are down simply because people are sourcing their tobacco on the streets.
Mm-hmm.
They're getting their cigarettes elsewhere.
Mm-hmm.
And nobody knows how many of those are coming in. You can speculate.
Well, you can. You can do litter bin surveys.
Yeah. Well, they did that in Cork to discover down here in the south about 30 to 35% of the litter bin products were illegal.
Mm-hmm.
That's huge. But that was dismissed completely as nonsense.
Right, I don't have a source for that. But let me kind of put one other point to you that suggests that this is very effective. And the reason I think it's very effective is because I think the tobacco companies think it's very effective. And the reason I think they think it's very effective is because they're fighting it like crazy. Doesn't this massive opposition from the tobacco industry to plain packaging indicate that it works?
No, it doesn't. Not at all. It's very simple. There's a difference between trial by media and trial in a court of law. The Irish government, like every Western government, has signed up to protect the IP rights. There's trade agreements, many of them, not just one, where our government has signed up to protect the IP rights of companies trading here.
Mm-hmm.
It's very simple. Now, the tobacco companies doubtless will take a suit that says they've signed this to protect us, and now they're stripping us of our IP rights.
IP means intellectual property. That's like the branding and stuff, yeah.
The courts themselves don't care about the health issue because that's not what they're looking at.
Yeah.
They genuinely are. That isn't their job, if you like.
Well, their job is to decide a point of law.
It's a point of law that says, well, look, have you signed these treaties? Have they got a case against you? That's literally what it comes down to.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, we have, and yes, unfortunately, they do have a case. And the taxpayer will end up paying for it, like with everything else. So I don't see that. Now, why then would the tobacco companies do that? Well, I can only tell you I worked for a very prominent computer company for years who had a very distinctive logo in seven colours. And if you published that logo in any wrong Pantone colour, any of the seven colours in the wrong Pantone, our company would have sued you for it.
Yeah, and that's very, very common because companies that invest many, many millions in brands, they do to different degrees, but yes, you're right, every company has a brand of some sort. Companies invest enormous amounts of money in that because they know it's worth it in sales.
It differentiates them from their competitor. Remember, the brand on anything, a brand on a motor car, Volkswagen on a motor car, differentiates it from Toyota. They're looking at somebody who's in the market to buy a car.
But you're correct that will allow people to differentiate between brands, but it also encourages people to buy a product that they had not previously bought. Apple put out the iPhone. There had been no smartphone before that, but Apple's branding meant that people bought it where they hadn't bought a competitor product previously.
The branding meant that this was a digital company that had a record of making quality products. That's what the brand meant.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you had to be in the market for a phone. You know, if you think about it the other way around, William, are you a non-smoker?
I am a non-smoker.
Okay. Well, why then don't these hugely attractive tobacco boxes attract you to try the brand?
For the same reason that hugely attractive Apple marketing doesn't attract me, I'm perhaps less susceptible to branding. But in other cases, I'm very susceptible to branding. Clearly,
in the market for something.
Absolutely, but Apple's branding increases their sales. The fact that it doesn't increase their sales to 100% of the population doesn't mean that it doesn't work.
No, it increases their sales. They're constantly sniping at each other for market share. You have four separate companies competing fiercely for the existing market share. They're not allowed to advertise, they're not allowed to market, they're not allowed to create a new generation of smokers to fight over. So they're fighting over the existing one. That's what they do. It's a very profitable business for them, I'm sure, but that is what they do. That's where the brand comes in, the gold box of Benson Hedges. This is distinctive, this is quality. Taking those away from them, in Australia, I've read a report from Australia, the Bulger Edgar report, and they're saying down there that the net effect of plain packaging is that it's devalued the premium brand.
John Mallon, thank you very much for joining us on Here's How. We have to leave it there.
Okay, William.
Here's How is Ireland's political, social and current affairs podcast. Make your view heard. Record a contribution to be included in the next show. Just dial 076 603 5060 and tell the world what you're thinking. Your voicemail may be included in the next podcast. You can find tips on recording your contribution and other ways to contact the show at hereshow.ie/call.
This is Dan Boyle, former TD and member of Shannon Aaron and former chairperson of the Green Party Quintus Glass. Here's how I believe the Irish media and the Irish political establishment is getting it wrong in terms of politically attacking Sinn Féin. The two main prongs of attack seem to be to discredit the organisation in terms of its past, and undoubtedly it is a past that many in the country find unhealthy, or to paint apocalyptic visions of what it would be like if the party were to achieve government. It strikes me that what is being missed by both the media and the political establishment, who themselves are in dire need of criticism and to be agents of change in their own right, but the total absence exists of any criticism of Sinn Féin as an organisation of the present. I believe most of this has been a reluctance to maintain Sinn Féin as active within the Northern Ireland peace process, and direct criticism of Sinn Féin on the basis of how they articulate and how they form policies, how the formation and practice of such policies might work in a government in which Sinn Féin take place, has been near absent from Irish political debate. Firstly, I believe that the discrediting argument does not apply at all to a whole generation of Irish people who have been born since the culmination, or at least the lessening of the violence in Northern Ireland and in other parts of this island. And it seems that the use of this as a tactic tends to drive newer voters in particular into the hands of Sinn Féin, who merely by existing are seen to be the anti-establishment engine of change for many people. Secondly, the type of apocalyptic visions that are being put before voters are ultimately very risible. In today's Irish Independent, we have two articles, one from an economist working with Goldman Sachs and one from former Taoiseach and leader of Fine Gael, John Bruton. The fact that these attacks come from these sources also have the same effect of bolstering up credentials for Sinn Féin that they wouldn't otherwise deserve. In reality, while by portraying itself as a left-wing party, Sinn Féin is also trying to ride upon the coattails of new anti-establishment left-wing alliances that exist in Greece in the form of Syriza and is developing in Spain in the form of Podemos.
I don't normally read the Sunday Independent, but I looked at the online version a couple of days ago and I went into the opinion section and I was really shocked. Almost every single article was an attack on Sinn Féin. I think that the Sunday Independent is an extreme example, but there's certainly a trend right across Irish political discourse that's very, very hostile to everything Sinn Féin. I note that at the start of your call, you said that the media was getting it wrong in the way that they attack Sinn Féin. That sort of presumes that their job is to attack Sinn Féin, and it's not. That's not their job at all. Their job is to inform the voters about Sinn Féin, to analyse Sinn Féin, and to offer that analysis to their readers. If you look at the Sunday Independent sometimes, you could get the impression that if Gerry Adams said the sun will set in the west this evening, the Sunday Independent will tell you that it will set in the east. John Drennan, in the run-up to the last election in 2011, wrote a piece that I think is worth quoting. He said, "The Sinn Féin leader Gerry Adams is struggling to avoid a humiliating defeat in the constituency of Louth. Typically, the Sinn Féin leader secures over 70% of the first preference votes in Stormont elections in his West Belfast homeland. But after an initial blaze of positive publicity, sources now believe Mr. Adams will be engaged in an embarrassing struggle with a pair of nondescript Fianna Fáilers for the last seat." In fact, Gerry Adams went on to top the poll in that election, and he was elected on the first count. Drennan's piece was a pretty extreme form of wishful thinking, and I think that type of hysterical attack on Sinn Féin does have an unfortunate effect. It gives the impression that Sinn Féin are facing intense media scrutiny, but it drowns out a whole range of analysis of what Sinn Féin is, who the people are, and what they're likely to do in government. It seems overwhelmingly likely that Gerry Adams was a leading member of the IRA in Belfast in the 1970s. If he didn't actually take part in it, he was certainly very close to the people who murdered Jean McConville. Those are certainly valid questions to raise with Gerry Adams, and many leading Sinn Féin figures have similar histories. But depending on your opinion poll, Sinn Féin is now close to being the most popular party in the country. There are lots of other questions that should be put to them as well. Questions about what they would do in government, and I don't think that they're being asked, and they're certainly not being answered. I've asked the Sinn Féin press office to provide a speaker to discuss these issues, and they've indicated that they will do that, so I hope to include that in the next edition of the podcast.
If you like the Here's How podcast, please rate and review the show on iTunes and other podcast providers. Share it on Facebook and Twitter. Tell your friends. But most of all, make your views heard. Call us on 076 603 5060.
Joe Leogue from the Irish Examiner, thank you for joining us on the Here's How podcast. Air Code is due to be launched during 2015. Can you tell us exactly what that is, Joe Leogue?
Yeah, Air Code is the postcode that will be rolled out for every address in the country. It's been a long proposed project. It was first announced 10 years ago by the then Communications Minister, Noel Dempsey, and it's due to be rolled out this year.
And you've written a few pieces for The Examiner about this. I think it's fair to say they had a rather critical tone. What would be your take on how it's being managed? And maybe first of all, deal with exactly how it's structured. What would be your take on that?
Well, I mean, first of all, I should say that, I mean, it's been reporting of criticisms that have come through from stakeholders in the process. That I mean, if the tone comes across critical, that's because it's reflecting the concerns that have been raised to date by it. I mean, the problem as perceived by those who've been complaining about Air Code, really, there's been a few different complaints, but the main one centres on the design of the code itself, in that it'll be quite different to how postcodes are done, for example, in the UK or the US. Where you have what's called a hierarchical code, which is kind of structured. You won't have that here. It'll be a randomized code.
So what that means is that my postcode won't be the same as my neighbor's postcode plus one. We should state at this point that every dwelling, including every individual flat in a block of flats, will have a different code. And the first portion of that postcode, so maybe in Dublin, D15 will be the postcode, will be the start of the postcode for the whole of Dublin 15, but after that, the next four digits will be completely randomised, and if I was in Dublin 15, the start of all of the postcodes would be D15, but by neighbour's postcode, the next four digits would be completely different to my four.
Exactly, yeah. I mean, the way of explaining it is, taking the Dublin postcodes aside to apply it to the rest of the country, it's a bit like your old landline phone number. You'd share an area code with the house next to you, but you know your house next door isn't going to be your phone number plus one. It's going to be a completely different number. And that's similar to the way that Air Code will be when it comes about.
Uh-huh. The reading that I've done from Air Code is that the reason behind that is, and it relates to somewhere, the road where I grew up on,
maybe now 150 houses on the same road have all exactly the same address, and in several cases where plots were split up, people also have the same family name and in a couple of cases the same first name. So if the postcodes were sequential, there would be only one character difference from one postcode to the next, and the reckoning is that that's not a sufficient distinction. Is that how you understand it?
Well, yes and no. The Department of Communications say that over 35% of Ireland's 2.2 million addresses are non-unique, which means, like you said there, a group of houses on a townland will share the same townland address on their envelopes. Your local postman will know, you know, John Murphy Sr. from John Murphy Jr., but if you were to have a delivery company bringing something out there, they wouldn't. And that's kind of what the department are saying will tackle it. I wouldn't say that's the reason why they're not going with a sequential code. The sequential codes that are used, again, to use the example of the UK, they don't identify individual unique addresses like Aircode will. Aircode will have a different code for every address, whereas in the
UK, I understand up to 26 dwellings can have the same postcode.
Exactly, it's a cluster of addresses. So the main reason why that has been expressed by the department for not using a sequential code is that, again, to use your example of your bunch of houses in a rural area, and again, like if you were to say a father was to leave a plot of land to his son next door, if you already have a sequence in place and a new house is built in between the two houses, what do you do when the code goes from one, you know, if you have house number 123 as an air code at the next door is 124, and then a house pops up in the middle, how do you sequentially, you know, how do you allow for a sequence to continue when there is a possibility that new builds could pop up in between? And I think that's the main reason why they don't want to do it in a sequential way, because they feel the need to uniquely identify each house to tackle the non-unique address problem, but they want to avoid sequential coding, because, you know, if a new build pops up in the middle of the sequence, how do you solve that problem?
I understand. There was also, I remember, because I wrote a book that had this as a large part of its topic a few years back, and the Data Commissioner at the time had made a statement that there were issues around this, but he didn't seem to be able to articulate what the privacy issues might actually be. Do you have any insight into that?
I think that there are groups like Digital Rights Ireland who might be better able to articulate this, but based on my reporting and talking to people like Digital Rights Ireland, one of the big problems that they see with Aircode is that the risk is unknown. If you adopt a postcode system that has been tried and tested in other countries, and I believe Ireland is the last country in the EU to adopt it, if you take a system that's been tried and tested elsewhere, you can use that as an example. You know the risks associated with it because they've been borne out in other jurisdictions, and you can learn from that experience and plan for it accordingly. Digital Rights Ireland's big concern, and they wrote to Mr. Alex White about this, was that I can't remember the exact phrasing, but they said we're taking a step into the unknown with Aircode, that we just don't know exactly, you know, what lies ahead when we're using this completely new and untested system.
I understand what you're saying. I think maybe that might be a little bit of a red herring, because if you combine the postcode with the house number in the UK, which includes Northern Ireland, of course, then you have a unique identifier for each dwelling. Joe Leogue from the Irish Examiner, thank you very much for joining me on the Here's How podcast.
Thank you.
Make your view heard. Dial 076 603 5060 and leave a contribution for the show. You can find tips on how to record a good contribution and other ways to contact the podcast at hereshow.ie/call.
That's almost the end of episode 3 of Here's How, Ireland's political, social and current affairs podcast, published on the 19th of March 2015. If you like the podcast, please go on iTunes and give us a nice review. That's very important. Also, please like the show on Facebook, please follow at Here's How Podcast on Twitter, and of course, subscribe to the show. You can use iTunes, Stitcher, TuneIn Radio, or any other podcast app or software.
You can do all of that right from www.hereshow.ie. Or you could just go out and meet real people and tell them how great the podcast is. The next show will be uploaded shortly. The Here's How podcast is produced and presented by me, William Campbell. Thank you for listening.